Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 72, section 7, which is old single column, page 815. All right, so deep in the midst here of government on a neighboring planet, as you I'm sure all recall, they're definitely burrowing in on some rather specific details. You know, as you can see, if you look back to what the subject was in section 6 there, that was about old age insurance. You're going, wow, that's a seemingly amazingly precise detail for them to be giving to us about the setup of government on another planet in a particular continent with a particular people. Why is that relevant? It might be out of just curiosity, just to hear something like this. But, again, it's a revelation of truth, first and foremost. You have to disclose some facts in the process of revealing truth. There has to be a coordinated essential knowledge. I've said it, I think, about every time as we've been reading this paper. The point is to appreciate that despite the remoteness of the facts, just literally because of the remoteness of the people, they're on another planet, they've given us this information because there's great potential, if one reflects on the truths flowing through these facts, it's going to have extreme relevance to, the very foundational rubber meets the road aspect of the emergency on this planet, right? That led to them giving us this revelation in the first place. We have this fundamental civilizational emergency. And so, in the context of these papers on civilization, as they use the details of these other people, to bring things to a factual focus, we should also be able to bring our recognition of the truth to a better focus, and in the process, see the contrast to what we have, the error of our system. And a lot of times it's not a standing error that goes back a million years to Andon and Fonta. Right? It's a very recent manifestation of error. Right? It begins in the beginning of the 20th century when we philosophically went dark. Right? The beginning of the endarkenment on this world that led to them giving us this philosophic text to help us to see the forest for the trees again. We're befogged by much thinking. We can't seem to get to the truth anymore. Our most brilliant people are hopelessly confused. There needs to be individuals that begin to re-synchronize with the cosmos. And it begins not with us trying to somehow change the evolutionary stream predicated on what's in my lap. We've built, especially in these civilization papers, when we got up to the states and we got up to the fact that states now have citizens, and we recognize that it's fundamentally a collection of definitive individuals, not just a group where the individuals are kind of amorphous in that group. Like clans and tribes and nations, mere nations. But you fundamentally have these cosmically attuned, integrous individuals. That's a prerequisite to maintaining statehood. There has to be some philosophic integrity, at least, you know, in a subset of the leader individuals in that society that's attempting to maintain statehood. So we're going to be hitting it, you know, this a further very specific issue of taxation. Well, what interest do I have in taxation? My spiritual consciousness doesn't care about that. Well, your mere spiritual consciousness doesn't, but your holy spiritual consciousness should. Okay. We need to find the truths here because, you know, we're going to quickly see there's a number of points that come out quite straightforwardly from what they present. You know, oh, that reminds me of something that's going on right now. And I can see how almost every person with any so-called education and voice doesn't think properly there. That's the emergency. So let's jump into it here, and I wouldn't be surprised if it takes us a while to wade through this section because there's a lot of very poignant facts here.
Section 7, taxation. The federal government is paternalistic only in the administration of old age pensions and in the fostering of genius and creative originality. The state governments are slightly more concerned with the individual citizen, while the local governments are much more paternalistic or socialistic. The city, or some subdivision thereof, concerns itself with such matters as health, sanitation, building regulations, beautification, water supply, lighting, heating, recreation, music, and communication.
Okay. So, step outside, like I was just saying, of just the immediate words on the page and the facts that they're pointing to amongst these people. Look at how they're distributing a truth through their hierarchy here, of the federal down to the municipal government. There's a couple of very carefully limited facts at the federal level now that you could say are quote-unquote socialism, right? Or paternalism, paternalism in the sense of you are taking responsibility away from the individual, even some freedom away from the individual, and putting it in your hands, the paternal benefactor, right? And you're doing that for them. You're assuming that responsibility, and they don't have freedom in that in that dimension anymore. Like a person doesn't have the responsibility of figuring out how to get water for themselves. That's supplied. They don't have the responsibility of figuring out how to have lighting for themselves. That's supplied, right? See, that's back in when you headed out west in the frontier, okay, all those things were your responsibility. There wasn't a socialistic construct, right, where you just were the benefactor in the group, but you obviously had a greater freedom. Right? You could decide just exactly what kind of a water supply you wanted. You didn't have to just go with what the city, says is the water supply, and et cetera, and all those various things. We all know that this is one of the biggest creeping cruds, in recent times in this, country. Is we're getting more and more paternalism at the federal level. Not only is there more and more, so it's becoming just completely flipped upside down. See, this is, obviously this, it should be it should be a pyramid with the base at the bottom, right? Not a pyramid with the base at the top, right? It's a, you know, like we're ever more constructing, where everything is being put up at the top, you know, which means it's hardly even a federal system anymore, but a national system. And not only are there is a greater quantity of a paternalism at the top in our system, but because of the disruption of philosophic integrity, the quality of what's up there is, you know, is decaying as well. Right? I mean, we're just losing all big picture sight of, you know, of how to properly have, you know, effectively an old age insurance, say. You know, that's kind of parallel to what they have, you know, and we saw that as a how they were very precisely recognizing how to keep it stable and ongoing, you know, and we've lost sight of that. And so we have a system that's just, you know, beginning to be based upon, you know, just imagination. It's not grounded anymore. So you know, there's a place, you know, this is, I told you, you know, we'd be actually getting to the socialism sort of thing. I mean, there's a place for collective phenomena. You know, you don't want to think in stark dichotomies, you know, of, you know, say capitalism, socialism. Right? There's a proper system can have a truth flowing through some of each. You know, and the easiest way to keep it from going astray and becoming dichotomous is to be very careful about that ism suffix, right? You know, as a first thought, you know, you would say capital, but not capitalism; social, but not socialism. The little qualification, you gotta be careful, because if you just have that, you're gonna end up thinking too existentially about it. You need to think more in evolutionary terms about this. You know, like for instance, when you're in a tribal state, what powers you to the next level of nation, you know, is kind of lifting up the concept of nation to a complete lifestyle solution, you know, a quasi-ideal, right? So that, you know, there's a place for nationalism, right? It's the only way to get tribes to nations. They're driven by nationalism. But once you have nations, then you have to let go of nationalism, right? Because all good things taken to extreme become bad, right? And you have to, you know, put a higher one. You know, the nations endure, but they're driven forward by internationalism. Okay. You know, and way enlightened life, you know, you can even start thinking in terms of globalism. But, you know, thinking about globalism when you still are struggling to get out of clans and tribes is way unstable. That's nothing but change without growth. If you try to live in that, you know, intellectual space, you know, just collapse everything. It's like, wow, I hear a lot of people trying to do that. Yeah, why is this book in my lap? Right? I mean, you know, we start to be able to unwittingly consciousize some of the elements of light and life, but forget where we are, you know, that we're in the material comfort era, and we're starting to slip back into the security age even. You know, like you've probably heard me say recently, I mean, if you've wondered if we're, it's like, well, are we actually slipping back into the security age? Well, think about how many times the word security comes up in public discussion now. It's right there. If you've definitively incorporated the truths of the security age into your structure, and you're seeing to the maintenance of that foundation of your structure, security is built into it. But if you're constantly going, oh, we got a security problem, you see, you know, it's slipping. You're falling back into the security age. I mean, you got to be talking about that all the time. A lot of it is literally due to us, you know, we're falling back, not, you know, we're literally falling back, you know, in a lot of cases. We're not sort of driving ourselves backward. We're just falling backward because we're trying to hold on to a way too transcendent an ideal for the situation we're in. And, you know, we don't have the ability to span such a great gap between ideal and idea. You got to keep the ideal evolutionarily appropriate. And if you don't, you have change without growth. That's potential evil, i.e. it's potential breaking of your relationship to unity, a fracturing of the system, right? And it all starts to fall apart like it is right now. Okay, so anyway, how they started out is, you know, is trying to temper any tendency that you might have to think in terms of dichotomies. You don't even want to use the word socialism as innately evil, right? Or something like that. It's like, no, it has its place as long as it's properly constrained. And if it's kept down where you can have an organic group, it's kept down at that local level, right? You're instead of getting ahead of yourself and imagining somehow you can have this very vast organic group yet. Now, we're not enlightened life yet. What else do we have there? It might strike you, the state governments are slightly more concerned with the individual citizen. Think about what they're getting at there. That's another thing where, for instance, our inability to keep mercy and justice separated. When you're up at the top level, the level of the federal government that may need to actually go to war against someone for, pragmatic reasons, if you've got this blurred and you're getting false material idealism into that, you're going to get all wrapped around the axle. You have to be quite independent, quite non-personal up at that level. Right? The personal needs to be down there at eye level, where it's literally possible. The delusion that somehow the federal government can be personal, right? That it can substitute, say, for personal relationship or family. That's just delusional. So you can see they recognize that. See, even at their state government level, it's only slightly more concerned with the individual citizen, right? Those higher levels are working on the big picture. Right? They're not really focused in on this individual and that individual. That's happening down there organically in the trenches, as it should. Okay, so those are the basic elements there. And you're starting to see, they're occasionally throwing in. They do have, a lot of complexity. They have subdivisions of cities, like we have in some of our bigger cities. They've got counties, and they don't just have what it initially appeared, where a federal, regional, state. They've got kind of the same sort of hierarchy that we naturally developed, and that reminds you again how natural and universal that is. That in one way or another, they're going to effectively have counties, like we have counties, They're going to effectively have weeks, like we have weeks, you know, and these sorts of kind of universal elements that get expressed relative to the world you're on. Okay, now the one thing that you may have caught that I purposely didn't mention in that list, you know, you got sanitation, building regulations, you know, beautification, et cetera, but that one up front, health, you go, well, wait a minute, what about that one? Well, they need to talk about that one a little more specifically in this next paragraph.
In all industry, first attention is paid to health. Certain phases of physical well-being are regarded as industrial and community prerogatives, but individual and family health problems are matters of personal concern only. In medicine, as in all other purely personal matters, it is increasingly the plan of government to refrain from interfering.
See, so isn't that interesting, see? They say at the end. You remember how in some areas are kind of almost like right with us, other areas are a little bit ahead of us, you know, 100 years, say, ahead of us in, you know, evolutionary terms. They obviously used to be in a mode that we have, you know, been getting ourselves into more and more here recently. You know, of thinking, you know, I think we ought to put that health thing way up at the top. And they obviously discovered experientially just how false a thought that was. It obviously gave them great problems. And so more and more, they're getting this clear in their head why that is completely upside down. You know, so that, you know, when they say health there in the preceding paragraph, okay, there's a little asterisk by that. I mean, the first thing that you're thinking of with health, government is trying to be as non-involved as possible, right? And we're going in the opposite direction, trying to get government more and more involved in replacing the family, you know, or technically a bureaucracy replacing family. And so, see, that's a truth that they're pointing out. They're even giving you a hint of how they didn't learn that one by looking either. They had to kind of learn that one by leaping. They had to start out with some erroneous assumptions and work it a while, and, oh, this is definitely not going as we had envisioned. Right? And they've tried to get it focused again. It's family, you know, individual and family health problems are matters of personal concern only. Right? In medicine and all the purely personal matters, it is increasingly the plan of government to refrain from interfering. So that's a very interesting, very relevant point that we're struggling with right now. They're trying to give us a clue about that. You know, you can say, well, why? Well, we all need to see if we can develop enough insight and wisdom to appreciate. It's obvious that if we don't, we'll go through a difficult process and we'll figure it out again like they did. But, you know, they're trying to give us a little hint there that it's worth a little bit of reflection up front. See if you can take it forward logically and discover, oh, wait a minute, I've just reduced my initial assumptions to an absurdity. All right, can you figure out why it's not going to work, why it's going to break, what things, you know, what aspects of the temperament of an animal origin creature come into play that disrupt your ideals, right? The way you envisioned it, right? I mean, you can read part four, you can even read the Gospels in the Bible, you get a little hint about one of the things, right? The masses around Jesus, right? What are they clamoring for?
Free food and free healthcare.
Yeah, free food and free healthcare. Right? You know, Jesus is trying to get them to put God first, seek first the kingdom of heaven. But if those animal origin creatures get a sense that there's maybe the possibility of free food and free healthcare, right, God is just way too abstract, right? And you can't even remotely get them to focus in. Right, they're clamoring for free food and free healthcare, and so it's you know, it's right there. You can see kind of that the fundamental temperament playing. You can't have a system that plays into our weaknesses. We have to be challenged to not kind of go with what's natural. It's like, but I don't like the responsibility and the challenge. And it's like, well, but you have to face it. It's like, well, I may die. Yeah, you may. But I'd like to imagine where no one ever dies. Well, that's an interesting thing to imagine, isn't it? There is no such world. Right? No matter how free the healthcare is, everyone still dies. We need to get real about these things. And not so fearful and grasping. That's a very interesting one that they put in there. But you notice it's not... There are some issues. Well, what about this mentioning about the group setting? Well, they point out the specifics. Right? There's certain phases of physical well-being are regarded as industrial and community prerogatives. Right? I mean, you have some basic things about regulations that sidewalks should not be built with sharp spikes coming up out of them. Right? That's an industrial and community prerogative that there's a regulation against making sidewalks like that because that's dangerous. Right? Okay, yeah. Right. Those sorts of issues, yeah. Right? But not to the point, even you notice, the businesses apparently don't offer health care. Notice even that. Okay. So, just think about how that's a bit of a socialized thing that we've developed. It's very convenient and handy, but you've offloaded some responsibility and some freedom and some challenge to others. So it doesn't mean that we have to adopt exactly the way they've adopted it, but you just, you at least should be thinking about that. It's like, well, how far should we go? Taking it away from just being a personal matter. Yep.
We obviously will do things very differently from there, but what really strikes me about the big difference is that they learn from mistakes.
Yeah.
And when I look at what we do, sometimes I think, God, can we ever learn?
Right, instead of doubling down, we're so certain that our initial assumptions are innately divine, and we just keep doubling down and tripling down. Maybe if we're more zealous, it'll work the next time. No, it's a false initial assumption. You can't predicate anything enduring on that initial assumption. But I like that initial assumption, and because it's pleasant to me, it's right. Oh, well, that's a wonderful definition of righteousness, isn't it? Right? They're trying to help us with these things. Yeah, and that's a very important point to bring out, Gene. Remember, that's something we've also lost in this country. We had a fundamental sense in our founding of that experimental curiosity. And courage, right? We're going to try something, we can think about it a little bit, but we know our insight is not infinite. So at some point, you just have to go for it, try it, observe it objectively. If it's not working as you thought, maybe, you can tweak it a little bit, or maybe you just need to say, okay, stop everything. Let's go back and start all over again from the beginning. We've lost that courage to just try something. You see when someone says, well, why don't we just try this? You just have this uproar. It's like, no, we need at least 30 to 40 years of studies. And it's like, we need to just try things. It's supposed to be a laboratory of experimental democracy. Right? Have the courage to fail so that you can gain some wisdom. Right? If we never allow ourselves to fail anymore, or at least never acknowledge our failures, but continue to delusionally call them successes, and wisdom will never occur. Right? You can't get wisdom any other way except through the tribulation of failure. We have to have the courage to just try something out. you know, and have it not work as we had hoped, and try to do it better again, wiser the next time, because of the tribulation that resulted the first time. Well, if we don't have that courage, thoughts about getting to light in life are nothing but delusion. All right, what else do they say here? As long as there's this big paragraph right before you go on, let me just remind everyone of, remember how we've talked about taxation a few times. Now, this spot's in the book, it's come up. And I've brought this out. Let's see if they come back. You know, one would think that those things we've talked about would come back around again, and they're about to here. So let's see what they've got here next.
Cities have no taxing power, neither can they go in debt. They receive per capita allowances from the state treasury, and must supplement such revenue from the earnings of their socialistic enterprises and by licensing various commercial activities.
Okay, so fairly straightforward statement, but you can see, okay, they've got a solid sense that we're struggling with, you know, about not going into debt. And you're like, well, maybe it's only cities. Well, we'll see as we go forward here. But you're already suspicious it's probably more than just cities where they're making sure that things can't go into debt. We obviously are way off the rails on that one. You know, we're off in complete imaginary land now where money just doesn't even mean anything anymore. There's so much, you know, not just the debt you always hear about, but, you know, unfunded mandates, you know, that are many, many times that, you know, which is effectively an indebtedness, you know, in our society. Right, if you've promised people more, to give them more than the entire assets of the United States, right, where you add up the, you know, the worth of every paper clip, every acre of land, you know, everything, you know, if you've already promised more than the entire assets of the United States, you know, then what does it all mean? I mean, there's a lot of people that that have a basic sense that there's potential problems there. And again, we'll see that they're so definitive about it, very likely they learned those lessons the hard way. Right? They took things to points of great difficulty for their economic system. But the other thing you see there is cities have no taxing power. Boy, so much for like New York City. Right? That sort of just is predicated on taxing power to the nth degree. There are many other examples like that, that we know have gone way off the rails. So it's like, well, if they don't have taxing power, how are they going to fund themselves? Well, for one thing, they keep all of their government, you know, very lean and efficient. Right? They know its place and they know where it shouldn't be. Right? So they don't have to come up for money with money to fund government that shouldn't exist in the first place. Right? But the more you replace faith and family with government and bureaucracy, right, the more you're going to have to somehow suck families dry to fund activities the government shouldn't be doing in the first place. Those are family activities. And because they're so removed from where they should be, they're going to be extremely inefficient and they're going to cost 10 times more than they should, at least. Okay, but you've got this system, see, where they've got this per capita allowance with the state treasury. So the cities are working very much kind of in the state context, but they've got these things of their own. You get a water bill, for instance, right? an electric bill, and they also license commercial activities. Okay, so they've got some revenue streams. Okay, what about a little bit more along this line here?
The rapid transit facilities, which make it practical greatly to extend the city boundaries, are under municipal control. The city fire departments are supported by the fire prevention and insurance foundations, and all buildings in city or country are fireproof, have been for over 75 years.
So there's some interesting things like that last little bit, you know, not fire resistant, but fireproof. That's an interesting little thing that they've built in. Now, you know, of course, we got to remember some of these things that they can do are a little bit more difficult for us, say, because we're a much bigger phenomenon than they are, you know, both geographically and people-wise, and complexity of people-wise. But, you know, they have some interesting different modes of, you know, of setting things up. You know, like city fire departments are supported by fire prevention and insurance foundations. They throw in these little thoughts like that. It's like, huh, well, I wonder if there's something that we could kind of do along those lines, you know, rather than, you know, we know that a lot of cities, their fire departments are getting into very difficult straits because they've got, for instance, pension plans that are pyramid schemes, you know, and stuff like that, where, you know, two levels down in this now, you know, well-established pyramid scheme, it takes 200 active firefighters, you know, to pay one retired firefighter. It's like, well, we don't have 200 firefighters in our city. Yeah, well, that's a problem for the retired firefighters then, isn't it, and their pension. And we've got, you know, we've got a lot of things that are out of whack. And so you wonder, it's like, well, you know, in what ways might this help with that or not? You know, they're trying to get you to reflect on different modes of setting things up. Let's see. And just, you know, again, when they throw in a number like, and it has been for over 75 years, you know, so there again, we see kind of very parallel again how, you know, a number of things are like 100 years ahead, say maybe, you know, or, and so they throw in those to remind you of, the relevancy of some of this. You know, we're just entering the space they were in a while back, figured out the errors, you know, and have come around the other side and set up systems that aren't false like that. You know, so it's important for them to tell you that they're a little ahead of us in various ways so that you, you know, you see the relevancy of this. They're looking at things in the rearview mirror that we're looking at through the windshield. Yeah. So they've got wisdom, see, that they can, that we can learn from. Okay, what else?
There are no municipally appointed peace officers. The police forces are maintained by the state governments. This department is recruited almost entirely from the unmarried men between 25 and 50. Most of the states assess a rather heavy bachelor tax, which is remitted to all men joining the state police. In the average state, the police force is now only one-tenth as large as it was 50 years ago.
Okay, so maybe to start with that last line, you know, that reminds you of how much success they've had in getting a hold of their society. You know, of course, we know that, you know, there's some harsh things to that phenomenon of it being only one-tenth. You know, we'll read about those here coming up, you know, in a couple sections. But nonetheless, even when it was a lot bigger problem, they've got a system set up. You know, police officers are occasionally going to die in, you know, the line of duty. So why have the social calamity of a now widowed wife and three little children? Right? That now the state has to do something with or whatnot. Right? So, you know, so they set up a very definitive system, you know, that either encourages you to do something they definitely want to make happen, setting up families, or if you're not going to set up a family, you're going to join the police force so you can get the bachelor tax back. Right? One way or another, you want to get out of that bachelor tax. Either face responsibility of being a husband and a father, or, right, you face, you know, oncoming fire. You get it either way. So, there again, you see how there's a lot of no-nonsense things that we, you know, we kind of squirm about. It's like, wow, that is like so just harsh and definitive. Right? But you get the sense they tried it loosey-goosey before, right, and discovered lots of problems. It's like, no, we just need to be very definitive about some of these things. Right?
Oh, I like that. I think that sounds great. You know, let's lose the income tax and let's put in a bachelor tax.
Right, yeah.
I guess they didn't have a population problem there,
huh?
They wanted to encourage families.
Yeah. I mean, they, you know, we kind of saw that up front that, right, they certainly aren't, you know, in a mode where, man, we've got to encourage just one kid because, you know, otherwise we're going to be mainland China, right? I mean, you know, they're in a mode where they can have solid, you know, families and, you know, they're wanting to expand. I mean, again, you got to remember if you're going to have a growing economy, it's a little difficult to do if you have a declining population.
Wasn't so overtaxed as ours.
Well, remember, it's just this island continent, right? The other continents are in a very benighted state. You know, it's a very harsh domain. But you know, this little group of people that obviously most of the Adamic uplift on that world, despite their default, are. You know, are pushing forward philosophically, and at least at the time they were writing here, there's no issue with overpopulation. And probably historically there was no problem with overpopulation because until they got a little bit more sophisticated society, there was probably a lot of death in wars with all of those other benighted peoples on all those other continents. Sure, that was, you know, keeping the population down, just trying to keep from being exterminated by the, you know, benighted hordes on the planet. So, you know, don't forget it. You know, it may sound like you're in some kind of idyllic, you know, isolated Athenian space here or something at times, right? But, you know, this is all very recent. It was a lot harsher in the not very distant past. Okay, so what else do we have there? Right, you got definitive limits on married men between 25 and 50. Not too young, not too old. All the little philosophic touches, you know, in their system like that. Let's see, anything else there? Oh, just the up front there. The fact that you don't have city police forces. It's kind of an interesting thing. You know, and again, it's like, well, we need to institute that. We need to, you know, eliminate city. No, not necessarily, but to reflect, I go, well, I wonder why they went that mode. Why did they decide it would work better if they had it at a state level solely rather than having it, you know, so this, I mean, maybe they recognized that there was just, it was getting too complicated if you had too much hierarchy in that mode, you know. I mean, you can kind of... imagine that if you want the system to work together well, you know, we know that one of the very first things humans learned is war by committee meant you were going to lose, right? The side that was going to win the war was the one that had a strong commander-in-chief. You know, it was concentrated in an individual, and you could, it just worked much better. You know, maybe it's a complexity issue. You know, we often see that where, who's in charge of this investigation? You got people stomping on each other's toes. You know, you got the state, you got the county, you've got the city, you've got the feds. I mean, maybe they recognized it was just way too complicated, and they needed to simplify it. For instance, yeah, one thought. Okay. Now. Little aside there. Back to kind of a little bit more specifically on this taxation, you know, immediate issue of taxation.
There is little or no uniformity among the taxation schemes of the 100 comparatively free and sovereign states. as economic and other conditions vary greatly in different sections of the continent. Every state has 10 basic constitutional provisions which cannot be modified except by consent of the federal Supreme Court, and one of these articles prevents levying a tax of more than 1% on the value of any property in any 1 year, home sites, whether in city or country, being exempted.
Okay. So up front, you see the states are like what our states are supposed to be, you know, individual laboratories of experiment. So you aren't trying to do one size fits all. There is taxation, but you know, we want to note the you know, the specifics, because therein lies the contrast to where we are. You've got these you know, all sorts of different schemes, you know, so that it, like they're pointing out, you've got very different sections of the continent, different climate, different, you know, topography, you know, hence different industries, you know, whatnot. And so they keep it so that it can be well focused to the local details. You know, you keep, you know, everyone feels like they have a system that's attuned to them, so they don't feel like there's some foreign potentates imposing, you know, tea tax on them, right? All right, they've got that built in to keep it local, and hence everyone can buy in on their, you know, we've set this up, this is what we want locally here. You wonder, what are these other basic constitutional provisions? But the one they give you is striking, right? Notice how fundamentally they recognize how you need to keep this very minimum so that you don't have the tax enslavement phenomenon that, you know, we saw in the preceding papers. You know, they were so stressing was, you know, meant certain death of your greater society. You know, when you just replace physical enslavement, you know, with economic enslavement. And Katie mentioned it just a little bit ago, you know, like we pointed out so much there, right? The fundamental fallacy, you know, such a fallacy that we had to change the Constitution in order to implement it. Right? It's that false. The income tax is so false. And you can see it here. You see that, you know, you go, you know, it doesn't feel like they're talking about income tax with stuff. Yeah, no, they're not. They know how false that is. Maybe they didn't before, and they do now. But, you know, and even when they do, you know, are taxing on, you know, property in various ways, you know, remember we saw before that home sites, unless they got really, really huge, remember, right, are tax exempt because they want to so encourage the family, you know, as the foundation of all institutions, of the whole society. But, you know, beyond that, right, prevents levying a tax of more than 1% on the value of any property. Wow. Right? Now, anything beyond that is, you know, they know is just abuse. You can imagine how strongly they recognize the concept of usury, for instance, you know, in parallel to a statement like that. So, and you go, well, 1%, it's so tiny. How could you ever fund a government? Yeah, well, again, right, you don't let a government be so big and beyond its of what the scope it should be, that you have to levy a 20% tax on everyone to keep it going. You should recognize philosophically you should never be taxing at that level anyway. And you should recognize that you shouldn't have unnecessary scope of government. And, the two work together. They fit together in a harmonious system. Everyone, if you don't pay attention to how much money gets sucked out of your paycheck every time, right, it's a little more than 1%,
The rest of my budget's for antidepressants.
Yes. And then on top of that, right, they're taxing income, which is just totally inappropriate. Right? Like they point out, way back in the book, when you get to light in life, you can think about having an income tax. We're a long ways away from such enlightened humans. Right? Right now, you're completely de-incentivizing. Right? And you're fundamentally telling the person your income isn't yours. It's the government's. Right? But we'll give you back some of it. Right? I mean, don't fool yourself. I mean, it's like, no, the income's mine and I'm giving them some. No. I mean, are you in control of how much you give? No. You're working for them. You're a slave. You're a serf, technically, right? It's their income, and they're out of their benevolence. They're letting you have some of it.
Can we get it back later in Social Security?
Yeah, well, theoretically, if it was actually set aside for you as an individual and wasn't thrown into the general pool like it is now.
Right,
but. But we all know, it's not just Social Security that's being taken out. And again, we talked about that with the old age insurance, about how many things we, don't have philosophically proper in the way we've set up our effective old age insurance system. Anyway, so they're definitely getting into some of these specifics, and you can easily see areas that they're at least so starkly in contrast to us, what we have set up, that you at least should give you some pause to think about. It's like, do you suppose maybe we're off track there? I mean, is it just that difference because there's that much of a difference between our two systems and that's appropriate? Or is that pointing to some, right, is the difference between truth and error not just, the necessity for facts to be different because the specifics are different, right? We need to figure that out. You have to be very suspicious that they wouldn't waste space in the book telling you something that was just merely a factual difference, and there's no truth to be had from them telling you that, right? It's most likely truth to be had there. Okay, now we're finally going to get to the federal government.
The federal government cannot go in debt, and a 3/4 referendum is required before any state can borrow, except for purposes of war. Since the federal government cannot incur debt, in the event of war, the National Council of Defense is empowered to assess the states for money, as well as for men and materials, as it may be required. But no debt may run for more than 25 years.
So they recognize, right, there are emergency situations, right, if you will, and you got to be able to go, respond quickly to the demands. But even then, no debt may run for more than 25 years. Right? So they obviously recognize that, the instabilities that you inject into the system with having long-standing debt. So you see the way they've got this. It's at the state level that you have some flexibility. It's rigid at the top and rigid at the bottom. Cities can't go into debt. Federal government can't go into debt. And so that leaves like, well, what's the philosophy behind that? It's kind of just opening up to reflect on that and figure out why did they set it up that way? Wouldn't it be more straightforward like to deal with the war thing since it's a federal effort to go to war? You have this National Council of Defense, not state councils of defense. Why didn't they, what's the idea there? We don't need to go into all of those details like that here, but just, obviously it's begging the question, right, for you to reflect on. And you notice the other little thing, aside from war, a state can go into debt if you have a positive result of a 3/4 referendum. So they, just the very fact that they have the possibility of a referendum. So they do have, like we have recall, referendum, and initiative, right? We do have those elements of a little bit more pure democracy, where we throw things to the people rather than having it being just done by our representatives. So that's interesting just in itself. That they obviously have a very definitive representative government, much more, precisely representative and complex than we have, as we've been reading about. But occasionally they do throw some things to all the people. But they put a stiff, 3/4 boundary on it. I mean, it's got to be a super majority, if you will, before they're going to, everyone's got to really buy it. It's like, okay, this is really, really important. Yeah, we are going to go into debt for a few years for this reason. But it can't be just a handful of people deciding the state's going to go into debt and all the citizens, just have to suck it up. Right? The citizens know they're the ones that are going to have to pay that debt. So, they need to give permission for it. So it's an obvious case where that handful of representatives shouldn't have the power to impose debt on everyone. Look at the debt each of us has individually, when you take the national debt and you spread it to all the citizens, right? None of us can pay it. So what does that mean? Right? Forget about 25 years, none of us could pay it, in a 1,000 years. And every one of us has it. So what does it all mean now? It's a very strange state of affairs that we've got ourselves into. Let's see, anything else there? As we transition to this next thing, you aren't totally certain still from what they've said so far that there isn't income tax somewhere in here. Now we're going to see, definitively how this works. If the income of the federal government isn't income tax, from income tax, what is it? Let's take a look here.
Income to support the federal government is derived from the following 5 sources. 1, import duties. All imports are subject to a tariff designed to protect the standard of living on this continent, which is far above that of other nation on the planet. These tariffs are set by the highest industrial court after both houses of the Industrial Congress have ratified the recommendations of the Chief Executive of Economic Affairs, who is the joint appointee of these 2 legislative bodies. The upper industrial house is elected by labor, the lower by capital.
Okay, let's start with the kind of the science in the latter part of that paragraph, and then we'll get to the more directly philosophy stuff in the beginning part. A lot of fascinating details there. Just look at, remember we've got that the industrial segment of their society with has 3 branches of government. You see, all 3 branches are involved in this process. With tariffs. And think about the philosophy of the upper and lower houses. right? It's the industrial segment of their society. So the lower house is capital, is elected by capital, right? But there's an upper house, right? You may have to, right, bring in a little bit more individual concern, right, to above that lower house, and so, right, that's elected by labor. So you can see the wisdom of that system there. Where the rubber meets the road, you know, kind of the more, you know, kind of direct representation, you know, in the industrial sector is capital. Okay, and, so you notice that, and you do see that it is being initiated by the chief executive, you know, in that segment, the chief executive of economic affairs, and then it goes to both houses of that Congress for ratification, and then it finally gets, you know, directly set, as they say there, you know, by the industrial court. Okay, so just kind of leave aside, you know, reflecting on all the science of that and the why of it, kind of beyond the scope of a Friday night group here. But what about the, you know, what is more immediately what we try to address in greater specificity in this context? You know, the first part of that paragraph. Let me remind you, before we look at that, you know, what they told us up front in this regard. You know, back there in section one, very important thing to remember in this regard. It said, these people, right, and the people on the island continent, these people are self-sustaining. That is, they can live indefinitely without importing anything from the surrounding nations. Right, that's the fundamental predicate here. Right? They know that they're not enlightened life yet. Right. They might have even been told one time that even when you get to light in life, you still have nations, integrous nations. You don't just have some global people. Nations go way deep, you know, into light in life. You know, and they know that there has to be, you know, a high degree of completeness to a nation, right? These people are self-sustaining. That is, they can live indefinitely, right? They've got it set up where they could literally be in complete siege, you know, for 200 years by the benighted peoples on the other continents, and they could sustain that siege, right? They're self-sustaining. So, you know, we've got to remind ourselves of that. We can't be thinking, oh, well, war is a thing of the past. We don't have to worry about, you know, being able to produce things ourselves. You know, we can always get it from someone else. You know, none of them are ever going to be our enemy. We're a long ways away from that state yet. And now we're getting, you know, we're in the specifics of that. It's like, okay, but there are these other places, and there is some interaction, and there are peace times even on that world. Okay, so what about, you know, trade? Well, how do you maintain that integrity? How do you, when you open yourself up to other nations, and have some measure of an international exchange of ideas and goods and whatnot? People, how do you keep the integrity of your nation? How do you keep it from all just diffusing out into the system? You know, especially when you recognize that, like these people do, and as we should, right, we're the spear point of progressing civilization, right? You know, and if we transfer all of our wealth to other countries, not only will we collapse, but everything will collapse. Remember, we always point out Abraham Lincoln reminded us all that at the end of the Gettysburg Address. If the light goes out, There is no light on the planet. There's an awful lot of people on this planet that have no interest in some sort of highly democratic advancing system. Billions and billions of people, not the slightest interest. They're very interested in authoritarian dictatorships. So, you know, they're still very much back in that, you know, monarchical stage of things. Okay? And we can't forget that. We have to make sure that we maintain some, you know, ability to be self-sufficient to a high degree. And how do you maintain? You maintain that with tariffs. Not only are tariffs, you know, the way that you make sure that you don't bleed yourself out and, you know, into the bottomless pit, but that's the fundamental way that the federal government gets income. We knew that for all the early part of our country until we got lost philosophically at the beginning of the 20th century and thought it was a great idea to get rid of tariffs and change the Constitution and replace it with income tax. Right. See, they know, right? That's number one, tariffs. Right? And it's like, well, I mean, it would require, you know, insanely, you know, debilitating tariffs to fund our federal government. Yeah, well, that's not a problem of tariffs. That's a problem of too big a federal government, right? Right. You know, our federal government is, you know, it's hard to even know what the multiplication factor is, how many times it is beyond what it should be, what the system was designed to support, what philosophically is appropriate. You know, so you know, you see it very much right there. And before I, you know, tariffs. Have I heard that term recently? Let me think. All right, is that not immediately in the news of today? Right, you know, and notice what happens. You know, we are so far beyond the beginning of the 20th century now. It's the moment someone uses the word tariff publicly, all of the so-called educated, intelligent people on the planet go apoplectic, like it's just the abomination. That's the endarkenment. That's how far off we are philosophically. Yep.
You know, what I see is not there in this idea of tariffs is any sense of fairness for the other nations. I mean, it's they're focused on their nation and what is good for their people. They're not even concerning themselves with the welfare.
And again, why? Is it because they're fundamentally selfish? No. I mean, why do you put your mask on first before you put your child's oxygen mask on if they come down in the airplane? Right. I mean, you're no good to all those people on the planet, you know, if you've evaporated yourself. Right. It's just fundamentally illogical. If you have the desire to help others, you have to have some means to help them. You can't help them from a state of destitution. Right? So, you know, we've lost track of that simple philosophic fact. I mean, you know, we have to make sure that we maintain that integrity, like Abraham Lincoln tried to remind us. Right? Because if we don't, you know, do you think that Saudi Arabia or China, you know, is really interested in, you know, in charitable works? Right. You know, so we need to keep this clear, right? We can't transfer all the wealth out of this nation. Right? It's like, well, if you just transferred it out, then there wouldn't be people in need. No, it's a bottomless pit. You transfer all the wealth out, They're all still in need, and you are now too. Right. It's just, it's, you know, if you don't put it on, your mask on first, you know, if you try to get it on the child, well, you die, and now both of you die. Right. It's just simple logic that we can't seem to keep straight in our heads anymore. You know, and it's because we don't have a cosmic consciousness. We don't have a balance about this. We have an unbridled unity consciousness, spiritual consciousness with no balance to with a material consciousness. Okay, I know I kind of belabored that, but it's, you know, we've been kind of building up to this, you know, through many things. I mean, you know, you see it right here. You know, they gave you this example of this other nation that that understands the fallacy of the income tax, right? And that appropriately the federal government is funded first and foremost by tariffs, because it's the federal government's job to maintain the integrity of the state. That's its fundamental job. Its job isn't to, you know, like they pointed out, to get down there in the trenches with the individual people, and right, it's not Jesus ministering to the condemned criminal. The state's job is not to minister to the condemned criminal. That's your job, right? It's the state's job to condemn the criminal, right? And like Jesus said, that's the state's right, right? And we have no place to question that. You know, it's the federal government's duty to maintain the boundaries between that state and other peoples. Okay. Number two.
Two, royalties. The federal government encourages invention and original creations in the 10 regional laboratories, assisting all types of geniuses, artists, authors, and scientists, and protecting their patents. In return, the government takes one half the profits realized from all such inventions and creations, whether pertaining to machines, books, artistry, plants, or animals.
Okay, see, you know, they've been mentioning there's these two things, like they did, you know, up front there. It's paternalistic only in the administration of old age pensions and in the fostering of genius and creative originality. And you can't like, well, what is that fostering genius and creative originality thing about? You know, we haven't really gotten to that. Well, now we've got the basics here. Right, you know, so these very inventive or creative individuals, they don't have to assume all of these, you know, kind of material pragmatism details, the responsibilities of that. The state assumes that those responsibilities. Okay, but that's at a price. you know, and that's reminding you, right, to deal with socialism is eventually you run out of other people's money, right? Socialism, you know, it appears to be giving things free. No, it's not free. There's a cost. So, you know, here you see that very directly pointed out. And
can't get 50% from a VC. Looking pretty sweet to me.
From a VC?
Venture capital.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, Chris C. makes a great point. You go, you know, if you don't know much about it, and you go, whoa, 50%, that's ridiculous. You know, I'm a painter, and there's no way I'm going to, you know, it's like, well, okay. Yeah, try putting it out there into just the ruthless profit motive system. See what happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do they do that with industrialists also?
I mean, in what regard do you mean?
In taking a big percentage?
No, I mean, the thing they do there, we talked about that, they have, they've got it very, very limited and precise about what kinds of ways there's income in the industrial sector, so that you don't have, you know, sort of just infinite avenues, and it's complex, and there's, you know, all these opportunities for greed and corruption and whatnot. They keep it very simple and structured, but there is a freedom within that structure to make as much money, you know, as possible. But the thing is, remember, they also said they're way ahead of us. You know, we're still very much where profit motive is almost universally indispensable. You know, it's one of the four indispensables, because we're still definitively in the material comfort era. They've begun to move into the quest for knowledge and wisdom, the next developmental epic. And so they've begun to evolve a proportion of their system from profit motive to service motive, because it's stable to do so. There's an integrity in the individual people. There's a human quality instead of just a fancy animal quality enough to the people that you can begin to shift that and not, you know, de-incentivize everything. I mean, now most of our people won't get out of bed if there wasn't profit motive. So, you know, unless you want to have a totalitarian police state, you know, beating people out of bed with billy clubs, you know, we're going to have something that'll get people out of bed in the morning, right? See, this is the only place where they have, you know, again, that socialistic or paternalistic sort of thing across the whole continent, you know, and they're reminding you it's appropriate here. But don't think that it's not a heavy hand, because it's, you know, there's a it costs a lot to support all that. Okay, what else do they do?
3, inheritance tax. The federal government levies a graduated inheritance tax, ranging from 1% to 50%. Depending on the size of an estate, as well as on other conditions.
Okay, pretty straightforward. They give you that little thing of it's not a one size fits all. So there's obviously a lot of reflection on making it appropriately organic. But you might say, well, it's like, wait a minute, we're always railing against the inheritance tax, or if people call it the death tax, right? Why is it such an issue with us? Because we also have income tax, right? And we go, wait a minute, that's just not appropriate. You're double taxing. I already paid taxes on all that. Now you're going to tax me again at an even higher rate?
Come to think of it, every time I spend my money, I get
it. Right?
That is double taxation.
Right.
Well, a lot of them just inherit, got it from their parents or their grandparents that were wealthy.
Sure.
People don't pay tax here because they can't.
Right. See, again, and that's because, like I said, we talked about that back in the industrial section, you know. All of that complexity we have, you know, there's a reason why our tax code is, 6 million pages long, you know. I mean, they've eliminated all that foolishness. They've boiled it down to very clean things, you know, and they don't have an income tax. They know how false that notion is, right? And in that context, right, you are going to have people building up, you know, vast sums of money. So you can tell from that it is allowed for people to build up vast sums of money, okay? But everyone recognizes, okay, that's way more than my family needs, no matter how many generations you think about it. Right? And so it's very appropriate for me, you know, to just, you know, give that to the federal government to help fund the federal government. That's an excess on my part that I gladly recognize I have the ability, and I even have a duty, right, to help support the federal government. I mean, how initially was our federal government started? By founding fathers with more money than they needed funding the federal government, right? We wouldn't have gotten started if we hadn't had some people with some means, you know, that could cut checks, right? There's a truth, you know, that's not only there in the initiation that we can see, like in our country, but ongoing. But again, it's, you know, it all works well because of how they've begun to move ahead philosophically in many ways. You know, when you're still in the material comfort era, there's a lot of tension to inheritance tax. But I think we could manage it if we didn't have the fallacy of income tax play also. Right? And we could all kind of agree that that was reasonable. You know, now it just seems egregious. Right? You know, it's covetousness, right? You know, it's the government coveting what we have, you know, and it's like, what about the Ten Commandments? Thou shalt not covet. Right? I mean, you see that, you know, you begin to see how, you know, because we've decayed so much, you know, we don't even have those basic things that the prince's staff was trying to teach us 500,000 years ago. You know, and so in the name of the greater good, right, we justify coveting other people's stuff. They don't, you know, that they don't have any right to that. You know, I should get some of that. You know, and it's like, well, but I think they'll probably kill me if I try to take it away. Well, what if I get the government to take it away from them and then have the government give it to me? Yeah, I think you did. You have something? Yeah.
I think we both did.
Well, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm trying to kind of collect my thoughts.
Right, there's a lot here, is it?
Can we look at these three different branches as taking out, each individually, taking after primarily one of the three sources and centers? And if we look at the taxation schemes, or lack thereof, in the various levels of government, meaning the state government, the federal government, and the local government, something about this kind of strikes me as being very first source and center.
You want to be careful about, remember, you can rationalize anything, and you have to be careful about blurring the threefold patterns together. There's more than one threefold pattern in the book. I mean, in reality. The threefold pattern of the first, second, and third sources of center is different than the threefold pattern that's right here, threefold actuality with unity, you know, that gives you, you know, that fundamental individuality, associativity, unity, threefold. Things, meanings, and values, threefold, for instance. Matter, mind, and spirit. The three branches of government are the pattern for that. You know, immediately on high is the three levels in the local universe system: the local system level, the constellation level, and the local universe headquarters level. Right, the executive is at the local system level. The legislative is at the constellation level. And the judicial is at the local universe capital level. You know, I don't want to go too far afield on that, but if you reflect on, well, why is there three levels? It's not because there's three sources and centers, right? It's individuality at the bottom, associativity in the middle, and unity at the top. You know, and then they repeat that at the super universe level. You have three levels again. You start out with a transcendent individuality, and then a transcendent associativity and a transcendent unity level. If you want to think about the immediate ways that ties back to the sources and centers, it's not first, second, third source and center. It's the paradise source and center, the third source and center, the second source and center.
I guess what I'm really, it's more the local government is the spirit of ministry to the individual.
Right.
the state government is the concerned with the individual, but also the arbiter of the individuals.
Right.
And then the first source and center is concerned with the whole and delegating as much responsibility as
right.
is responsible.
Okay, there is that. There's a measure of, inescapably in a hierarchy, you have thought, word, action, right? The thought at the top, being expressed in word below and then going into action down in the trenches at the bottom. Yes, so you do have that. Right, but that's a little bit different. See, than the three branches of government.
I didn't mean the three branches of government, but the three scales of ministry, I guess.
Oh, okay, okay, that's okay, okay, okay.
That's what I was. All right. More talking about.
Yeah, because kind of see in a sense when you express, even though it's. It's vertically on high when it's projected down below. In an immediate sense, the three branches are all in the plane. They're horizontal, see?
I guess, so less in the sense of executive, judicial, and legislative, some combination.
Yeah.
It's more in the sense of, say, local universe, super universe,
paradise. Whenever, like I said, if you have a hierarchy where you're thinking about something that is being downstepped into action, right? Then obviously there's a parallel to thought, word, action. Okay, yeah, okay, and just that, projecting from will to the action along the way, if you will, there's another little element that comes in when you think of that thought, word, action. Action has to be somewhere. Mm-hmm. Who sets up, if that's where the rubber meets the road, where does the road come from? Right? If the God of action is the rubber meeting the road, where does the road come from? Does it come from the first source and center? No. Does it come from the second source and center? Right. It's that other part of the picture. God the Mother is the way. Right. God the Father is the will. Right. And there's this means for expressing that will into action. Right. Isn't starting with an existential sequence, there's the existential will, the existential word, and the existential, God of action. But there's the other part of the picture, right, we've never been told about until the fifth epical revelation. Right? It's the fifth epical revelation of God the Father, but it's the first epical revelation of God the Mother. Right? The Father is not the way. He's the will. He's delegated the way. It's one of the things the first source and center delegated. Pardon the pun. We often see that as we're thinking about the details. Of a human system. What part of this is, can you kind of see as a parallel to the thought God, the word God, and the God of action? And what part of it is something different than that? That seems to be the context within which the action occurs. Who's in charge of the context? Right? When I say up front every time, this distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. The Father is a part. He's an infinite part, but he's still just a part. He's not the whole or the individuality of the whole. So who or what are those? Okay. And that's it. That's the part that's only now being revealed to us, and is the basic challenge of recognition to get out of the old wineskin of rationalizing everything with just the Father you know, even if you augment that to the seven absolutes, right? You still just have the seven absolutes, you know, and you have them introduced in the beginning, and they say that there's seven coordinate absolutes. What coordinated them?
Yeah.
There's obviously something missing in that picture, right? Yeah. There's, you know, they're coordinated within a context. Where did the context come from? Right? The Paradise Trinity is the whole. Right? The Paradise Trinity is not the first triunity, not the three persons. It's the fourth fact. Right? It's the immediate thing that's obviously missing from that list of absolutes. It's like, well, what about the Paradise Trinity? Why isn't that in the list of why isn't there eight? and, you know, so the whole is the Paradise Trinity, and the individuality of the whole is the mother. And the mother is a very complex fact that is not immediately understandable in an anthropomorphic sort of mode that we've always been in, you know, and trying to get an initial sense of the universal father. Anyway, back to the context here. All right, so we see this whole bit with these tensions that we're struggling with the inheritance tax and the income tax, and and you can just see how between them rising to the challenge of having individual integrity, so they know well their responsibilities. Right? They also have a philosophic top-down view on this, knowing what's false and what's true about government. Right? Okay, what else? How else do they get some income for the federal government?
4, military equipment. The government earns a considerable sum from the leasing of military and naval equipment for commercial and recreational usages.
Right, so if it's peacetime, right, things aren't just sitting there.
You can rent an F-16.
Take that battleship out for a cruise on an afternoon. Yeah.
Because when you think of our military, and you think of a convoy, maybe it's on the train going down the track.
Uh-huh.
On the road, you see a military convoy.
Yeah.
How old are those trucks? They're ancient.
Yeah.
They would be so out of date now in any kind of an armed conflict, you have to basically start over and build new ones.
Yeah, we all know that until just very recently, I mean, it was literally World War II vehicles, you know, that were going down the street, you know.
So the thing is, isn't this going to wear them out? Well, yes, but you can replace them with new up-to-date versions.
No.
And instead of trying to make something that existential.
Yeah.
That's
exactly.
Needs to be more dynamic.
Right. You're seeing how, and we've talked about that, how innately dynamic and progressing they see their system, and how we just are getting more and more falsely existentialized. You know, the way we think about stuff. You know, we set this up now. This is eternal. You know, and it's like no, everything. It's just material things. I mean, matter is governed by the second law of thermodynamics. Entropy, right? Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. You can't think existentially about material stuff, right? It has to constantly be moving on to the next expression, right? And yeah, I mean, you know, still flying B-52s, right? Yeah, is amazing. they're cool, I admit, you know. If you sit right under them when they're taking off and their wings, you know, go whoosh, whoosh when they lift off the ground. It's pretty cool. Yeah, but it's a B-52, people.
How many cycles will that go through?
All right. And then remember there's this other element of socialism that they've implemented in their system.
5, natural resources. The income from natural resources, when not fully required for the specific purposes designated in the Charter of Federal Statehood, is turned into the National Treasury.
Okay, remember we saw that, you know, in the old age insurance that, you know, kind of the way we have like national parks as a public possession. They have all their natural resources as a public possession. And, you know, and they mentioned there about, you know, the income therefrom is utilized for social purposes such as disease prevention, education of geniuses, and expenses of especially promising individuals in the statesmanship schools. And then also one half of that went into the old age, you know, insurance fund. And, you know, as they point out here, it's like, well, if there's any left over, you know, it just goes into the the general pool of money to fund the federal government. You know, and like we pointed out, you know, that's a very difficult thing to think about just implementing, taking away everyone's mineral rights and water rights, for instance, and putting them in the hands of the federal government. But nonetheless, you know, think about it out of the specific. You know, again, the basic point is there. It's not wholly inappropriate to have some things in the public possession. But just, you know, all good things taken to extreme become bad. I mean, you can carry that too far. I mean, you can tell how they recognize it's just got to be a very few things, right? That you sort of nationalize like that. Everything else, you know, needs to have, you know, we saw at the beginning of all this about civilization, how important private property is, right? That you've got, you know, you'll never get anywhere without that being a fundamental foundation, right, of your civilization. So.
Did Doug's question answer earlier?
Oh, Doug didn't get his question answered earlier. That's right. Thank you.
It was a comment.
Yeah.
It fits in way back.
It fits way back, right?
So what I was going to say is that them having a simplifying their government on the planet enables the ordinary citizen to understand things well.
Yes.
Which helps a lot. Then you can work with the government. So if we had a simple government, then the people would be happy to interact and support.
Yeah, I mean, think about how logical we are about that. We're always complaining about big business, you know, being in league with government. It's like, well, it's big government. Only big business, I mean, can be in league with it. I mean, there's a quantitative mismatch, you know, any other way. I mean, we've set it up so that the only people that can interface with the government is big business. You know, so stop complaining. Big business is like we've set it up that way, right? You understand? See, you see that truth. It's like if you don't want that pernicious system, the government can't be big. It has to be something that the individual can interface with if you want to get it back to the way it's supposed to be. You've made it so that it's completely beyond the scope of an individual.
Is that kind of a catch-22, though? Because the government can't change into smaller government. Well, big business wants them to stay the way they are.
Right, of course.
They're both supporting each other in this really strong bond.
Right. And that's why when someone challenges that system, right, big government and big business, you know, scream in unison because they're, you know, they're joined at the hip. Right. You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Yep.
Think about the natural resources, I don't naturally cotton to their way.
Right.
Nationalizing all the natural resources.
Right, like I said, that's kind of, you know, that's kind of harsh for our tradition, yes.
You know, ownership implies the right of use, to the right to determine what to do with what you own.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just implicit in the concept of ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about natural resources, they're heavily regulated. And so why are they so heavily regulated? because there is a public interest there.
Yeah.
So they just, instead of making it this complex
regulatory system,
they just went all the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing, too, you want to think about, you can, you know, even though we don't know all the details, it's pretty obvious from what they do tell you, probably one of the things behind them nationalizing, you know, the natural resources is the state of affairs on the planet, right? I mean, you have this very poignant, I mean, every other one else on the planet gets up, you know, from the moment they wake up until the moment they go to sleep, is thinking about nothing but how to kill the people on the island continent that they hate. Right? I mean, the entire planet is dedicated to the destruction of this island continent. Right? I mean, it's a very Mad Max world on that, you know, outside of this island continent. Right? The rebellion and the default on that world, right, had an extreme impact, you know, on all those other continents. They're in a very benighted state. You know, and so just that fact that, you know, if they have to prevent the divide and conquer thing, right? Natural resources are very fundamental to that national defense against the hordes. You know, so I'm sure they learned early on, you know, there was just way too much division and, you know, squabbling. And they, you know, if we need, you know, lots and lots of steel for lots and lots of ships, you know, we can't have all of this. You know, well, that's my steel, and I'm not going to give it to you, or whatever. You know. So they probably, that's my iron. Of course, is what I mean, right? You know that. You know, that's probably one of the things behind them nationalizing it at some point. It's just that necessity of the world they live on.
It's the resources. It's not the companies that do
that. Right. It's not right. It's not literal full-on socialism of, you know, they don't have control of the production and distribution relative to those natural resources. It's just the natural resources themselves. You know, like I was saying, it's not the steel, it's the iron. Right? Yeah.
Sort of do the eminent domain version of that.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, occasionally, you know, we use eminent domain when the government needs to usurp some things. And, you know. All right. What else do we have here?
Federal appropriations, except war funds assessed by the National Council of Defense, are originated in the upper legislative house, concurred in by the lower house, approved by the chief executive, and finally validated by the Federal Budget Commission of 100. The members of this commission are nominated by the state governors and elected by the state legislatures to serve for 24 years, one quarter being elected every 6 years. Every 6 years, this body, by a 3/4 ballot, chooses one of its number as chief, and he thereby becomes director-controller of the federal treasury.
You know, wow, what is all these details? They're giving you some details. We don't really have this Federal Budget Commission, you know, to this complexity, do we? Yeah, so you can see that right away, that they're pointing out that, you know, these people recognize that you need kind of, you know, a very well-developed professional system there in play. And you also see, you know, they're giving them the details about where it, you know, originates, in which house. You know, remember, if you go back in section two there, you know, they say the appropriations originate in the upper house. Well, what's the upper house? That's the one that's elected by industrial, professional, agricultural, and other groups of workers, remember? Balloting in accordance with economic function. Right, so that's, you know, it's originating in that practical setting. You know, not in the lower house where it's based upon social, political, and philosophic groups. Yeah. So just, you know, without going into the details, you can obviously reflect on that, a little bit of the wisdom there yourself. And we'll come back to that construct. That when we get to section 9, we get a little bit more details about why they've set up the houses of their legislative branch that way. Let's see here. Anything else I want to bring out there? The notice the philosophic element of making sure that you don't have a runaway federal government in this regard, keeping the states and their individuality very much in play. Yeah, and of course we see that problem extensively. Wanting to turn everything into one size fits all. People that not only don't know anything about the states, but all they know about is that little region around Washington, D.C., you know. And so the members of this commission are nominated by the state governors and elected by the state legislatures. See, so they've kept that, they've kept it a federal government very definitively, see, and not letting it get into a national government situation like we've gotten into. And then not to mention, giving you, notice they serve for a relatively long span of time relative to those other terms that we saw, so that you have this overarching integrity of these, budget professionals, if you will, to a degree.
How can they do a three-fourths ballot?
Yeah.
How did they can't ever get to three-fourths?
Well, again, remember, that's one of the things between the lines, and they're about to mention it here in the next section. Right? Remember the predicate of all the people that are involved here. They've all gone through all of this schooling that they're about to tell us about. Right? There's a high degree of kindred minds there that we can't even imagine here. Right? Right? They can get on the same page there, like we remotely can't even imagine doing here. Let's see if we can get into this Section 8 here.
Section 8, the special colleges. In addition to the basic compulsory education program extending from the ages of 5 to 18, special schools are maintained as follows. 1. Statesmanship schools. These schools are of three classes, national, regional, and state. The public offices of the nation are grouped in four divisions. The first division of public trust pertains principally to the national administration, and all office holders of this group must be graduates of both regional and national schools of statesmanship. Individuals may accept political, elective, or appointive office in the second division upon graduating from any one of the 10 regional schools of statesmanship. Their trusts concern responsibilities in the regional administration and the state governments. Division 3 includes state responsibilities, and such officials are only required to have state degrees of statesmanship. The fourth and last division of office holders are not required to hold statesmanship degrees, such offices being wholly appointive. They represent minor positions of assistantship, secretaryships, and technical trusts, which are discharged by the various learned professions functioning in governmental administrative capacities.
Like the IT guy or, whatever. Right? But, number one of these special colleges is this, very extensive, rigorous statesmanship school system. Right? They don't have the hopelessly clueless, aphilosophic people that we have in our government, right? Right. I mean, you're required to be well-educated in the philosophy of government, not just the science of government, but the philosophy of government, to even get a position, be it elective, appointive, or even, the political there, even just the run-of-the-mill bureaucrat, right, down in the system, right, that was just hired, it wasn't appointed or elected, right? Right, they all have to have that integrity. The higher the position of public trust, the more they've had to demonstrate, right, a very advanced a level of a big picture consciousness about how, you know, what kind of wisdom, insight, and foresight are required to understand the system and maintain the system. Okay. So, you know, that would be a huge thing, you know. We could overcome a lot of our difficulties, again, if we had philosophic integrity again, you know, which we basically have just completely lost. And it was gone in such short order. I mean, it just all just disappeared in a flash at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, in relative terms. It took 2,500 years, right, to build up, and we just evaporated it, you know, overnight practically in relative terms. All of that that we'd built up through all of that difficult trial and error, experiential learning, reflective thinking, everyone is just completely oblivious to it now. You know, we don't even have the basic wisdom that, people thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago had when they wrote the book of Proverbs. You know, we don't even have that wisdom anymore.
What happened at the beginning of the 20th century?
What happened is you naturally have an evolutionary phenomenon that builds up, like, say, biologic evolution. It builds up to an apex. And when it reaches the apex, you're given revelation. You're given, in that case, biologic uplift, because you can't go beyond that without help from above, if you will, you know, that takes it further up from there. Evolutionary philosophy had reached, its apex about what we can do bottom up, just as humans. The only way you can continue it up is with revelation. Oh, there was a philosophic text given to us at the beginning of the 20th century, and that's why, right?
What was that?
That's what the Urantia book is, right? Now, it is the metaphysics that you need, the true metaphysics that you need to complete the picture and take it, continue to have it continue to move up. In the absence of that, along with some other, we don't want to get all the details, the other issues that came into play, we lost it all. To the point where we basically decided, that was 2,500 years of delusion. What were we thinking? That there isn't even something called logic. And that was all just the delusion. We were thinking that something could be self-evident or anything like that. We're all just totally subjective, and we have no potential to see anything objectively. We've been kidding ourselves for centuries, and so we just threw it all out. And we're just wandering in the wilderness now again. And in very short order, we reverted to some very primitive things that, haven't been there since the 7th century B.C. Right? I mean, we just snapped back to, we lost all of that, the fruits of reflective thinking. Right? I mean, the United States was predicated on the fruits of evolutionary philosophy. Right? The founders, took the true essence of what had been figured out and embodied it into the construct of the country.
It seems like it was pretty bad back then, too.
Well, I mean, there's the seeds for this were being sown in the 19th century. Some ideas, some very false ideas were being promulgated in the 19th century, especially, from the middle of the 19th century to the end of the 19th century. But it all sort of, reached, sort of that tipping point, if you will, if you want to use a term like that, or that critical mass, where everyone just got befogged by much thinking, we lost our way. And like I said, I could get a little bit more specific about some of the things that sort of really were behind that, how we sort of willfully, started to reject this. But But nonetheless, we did. And, it's why the Revelators say that, you know, you're either quivering on the very brink of moving out of the material comfort era into the quest for knowledge and wisdom, or you're going to lose everything, and there's going to be an interregnum. There's going to be a new dark ages. It'll be darker than the previous one. And that darkness that we talk about with the dark ages, that's a philosophic darkness. It's just losing that big picture and kind of getting lost in the weeds of our lives, right? Having no way to kind of contextualize, you know, your life, and you're just, you know, just a helpless victim being batted around, you know, in an ever more inscrutable state of affairs. Right? So we at the very least, you have to have leaders that have that big picture, you know, and keep things going forward. So, you know, the Revelation is here, you know, to try to give us the potential, at least, to not go into that interregnum. It doesn't guarantee it. They can't. That would be rebellion if they tried to guarantee that outcome. But they have to give us the potential, at least. It's in our free will hands about what we do next. Do we learn it through the school of hard knocks again? Or do we learn by looking instead of by leaping? Can we find the insight to penetrate through the words of this book and recognize the truths that are flowing through the words and begin to obey those truths again?
Do you see the interregnum as inevitable if the world doesn't get into this revelation?
Not necessarily. There could be other things. I mean, there's all sorts of wild cards that could be thrown in. Machiavelli Melchizedek may decide to, you know, assume planetary prince, or a magisterial son could come, or, you know, a son that's not even revealed in the Urantia book could come. I mean, who knows? I mean, there's always possibilities. You could have another spiritual quickening event like this 6th century BC, right? The last time we had an emergency revelation with Machiavelli Melchizedek, 4,000 years ago, they were watching the fruits of that effort, you know, and as the centuries rolled on, it's like, we gave it our best shot, but it's not going to work. They're going to lose it. There's not going to be anything here when Michael arrives. He's going to come to a dead field. It doesn't matter how many seeds he throws out. It's all going to die. And then suddenly, right, unexpected to everyone, right, there was a coalescence out of the whole and an awakening in the 6th century B.C., it is going to work. Right? See, that mother influence stepped in when all the father influence failed.
That's when Buddha came along.
Not only did you have all of the religious, you know, elements of the 6th century BC, and all the religions, basically, but all of the recognition of philosophy and, you know, beauty and democracy and stuff in Greece. That was also the 6th century BC. That's why 2,500 years takes you to the beginning of the 20th century, right? Right, to 6th century BC forward. We're getting kind of late. Let's see if we can penetrate through some more of this here.
Judges of the minor and state courts hold degrees from the state schools of statesmanship. Judges of the jurisdictional tribunals of social, educational, and industrial matters hold degrees from the regional schools. Judges of the federal Supreme Court must hold degrees from all these schools of statesmanship.
So again, you just see, you know, not accepting all of the judicial branch. Right? There has to, I mean, they need great philosophic integrity, of course, as the Revelators have been stressing in previous papers. I mean, they're the ones that need to make sure that, you know, bottom line, the philosophic integrity is maintained. Our judicial branch failed us when it allowed the fallacy of changing the Constitution and allowing for income tax. You know, they're the ones that need to tell everyone that's all caught up in, oh, I think this is a great idea, this is the way. They're the ones that need to say, no, no, I remind you of the fallacy of that. Right? That's fundamentally their job. Right? The judicial branch is like Van and his group. Right? The ones that make sure that, you know, all the other ones that might get caught up in some little whirlpool of subjectivity, right? There has to be a group that keeps the big picture, you know, and has the ability to say, no, let me turn you the correct direction again. Okay, now go ahead again. Right? There has to be someone that oversees the big picture. Anyway, so yeah, they've you know, they have that whole hierarchy of relationship to the scholarship schools. All right, what else we have here?
Two, schools of philosophy. These schools are affiliated with the temples of philosophy and are more or less associated with religion as a public function.
So there we see, right, you know, well, isn't the statesmanship schools the schools of philosophy? Yes, but there's kind of a more specific ones. And there we see, like we've mentioned, you remember, their religion is more innately true because it's in the sphere of philosophy, fundamentally. So you see it very directly there. Their science, likewise, is true because of that. Okay.
Three, institutions of science. These technical schools are coordinated with industry rather than with the educational system, and are administered under 15 divisions.
So you see they have specialization, definitely, 15 divisions, even at the highest level. So that's, you know, that's, and that's obviously natural. You know, and keeping them very much, you know, they're involved in where the rubber meets the road, right? So they're not often in airy-fairy land. Right. You know, that coordinated with industry. Okay.
Four, professional training schools. These special institutions provide the technical training for the various learned professions, 12 in number.
Again, a lot of specialization. You know, we all know that we need to rediscover, you know, some of that. You know, we haven't totally lost it. You know, and we have technical schools, but you know, we need more of that again, and apprenticeships that are involved in it and stuff again. We need to get back to that. So, you know, it's always encouraging when you hear some people that haven't gotten lost in theoretical land, you know, reminding us that we should, you know, develop, you know, apprenticeship systems and everything that goes with them again, because that's very important.
Five, military and naval schools. Near the national headquarters and at the 25 coastal military centers are maintained those institutions devoted to the military training of volunteer citizens from 18 to 30 years of age. Parental consent is required before 25 in order to gain entrance to these schools.
So two basic elements there to just touch on. You know, one, you notice there's 25 coastal military centers. You know, just reminding you again how assault comes from every quarter on that world, on that poor island continent. And one can only wonder if this hasn't even, you know, magnified, you know, since this was written. Because like we saw, remember, last time, they're about synced up with us in terms of technological development. Just as we were developing cars, they were developing cars. And so, oh yeah, just as we're developing nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles, they're developing that. And, you know, the benighted continents, well, would eventually get their hands on that stuff. And so it's probably even more of an issue now that they have to have that. Yeah, you got something there?
Well, they didn't say how these schools are funded. But I kind of get the impression, like the state, the national schools are probably funded state by state and region by region. But
there's probably also some of those special
tuition probably doesn't really play into it. Yeah. I think the competition to get into these schools is fierce.
Yeah.
But the cost is probably nominal.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my impression.
Yeah, and they also kind of hinted at it seems like they probably set up some kind of special councils or foundations, you know, that work some of those details like that. You know, again, they don't give us all those details, but then the other thing there, besides just, you know, that issue of how they have to defend themselves from every direction, you can see how it's a volunteer military, and you know, it's just 18 to 30. You would guess that they probably try to foster just bachelors again. But, you know, in times of war, you know, you've got to, you may need more hands. We know how that works. But, you know, notice how, you know, they've got that issue that we've struggled with some, you know, about how young a person should be in the military, you know. We've stressed over 18-year-olds dying in Vietnam and things like that. So they have 18-year-olds, but look at they've got that parental consent is required if it's before 25, because they know that, you know, before 25, you know, or thereabouts, you can have a lot of sixth adjutant zeal amping up a young man, you know, and not a lot of wisdom yet. And the parents may need to say, no, and if they can't get into the school, they can't get into the military. And so they're trying to temper some of that, youthful romanticizing about battle, right, by having the parental wisdom injected in there.
Exclusively male.
I'm only saying that because remember we got hints that it seems like they're still in a mode where a lot of things are pretty male. Yeah. You saw it directly stated with the police force. So yeah. Your first guess would be, but who knows? You know, in the last 100 years, maybe there's been some evolution there. But
they use volunteer citizens.
Yeah, we could say, well, you know, there were shield maidens with the Vikings, okay. maybe they have some of that sort of mentality, you know, and there were women, but.
They did call out the bachelor thing.
Yeah.
The police, and they didn't call out anything here.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'm thinking it probably is mixed.
I would agree that it's not, I just noticed that, your first thought is that it might still be quite male dominated, who knows? We can only speculate. We can only speculate.
Meritocratic, right? If you have skills, why not?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, you can tell that they're very wise about using people where their skills are appropriate. So, sure. So they may very well. Well, maybe it's only the men on the front line,
or
Gonzo women, right?
Pilots,
yeah,
right. Russians, right. I think also,
right. Right. I mean, you can obviously, they're so parallel to us. You can obviously think that some of the things that we do, even in Arab, societies, we've got female pilots, right? So, But just, remember, we saw signs that they, at least at the time of the writing here, there was a little bit more seeming of, of a male dominance than you might think. So, I don't know. That might be a weak spot that they're slowly overcoming with a more objective philosophic perspective, and it's improving definitely with time. I don't know. Yeah, you got something too?
Yeah. Did you say, I just want to clarify, they get into the military and have to do that in order to get into school?
Yeah, you see here that, parental consent is required before 25 in order to gain entrance to these schools. Right? See, you're going, oh, okay, school first. And, you know, I mean, we obviously have, we have training, you know, for a lot of people to, you know, but you can see for them it's a, it's much more universal. Right? There's a, they think a less in terms of cannon fodder, you know, it appears. Right? Okay.
Maybe that's the, and we use the military to absorb a lot of bachelor men, and it mm-hmm. seems like they use the police force for mm-hmm. that purpose.
Yeah.
So the military is a little bit more specialized and prestigious, perhaps, instead of that cannon fodder role.
Yeah.
The state police force.
Right. I mean, obviously, in full-out war, you know, they're, you know, your job is not to question why. Your job is to do and die. But yeah, I mean, but just, you know, in the context, you can see what you're saying. I mean, this is in the context of institutions of science, schools of philosophy, statesmanship schools, right? So the fact that it's in that list, right? There's a philosophy, you know, of the military, right? You know, that they have. You know, it's not just, you know, how to hold a gun and pull a trigger, right?
This may be a little bit of a tangent too, but one, we know they're in control of the whole island, so probably a lot of their combat is ships and air force, so that's, you gotta have a lot of stuff, and then once somebody actually makes it onto the island, perhaps your state police force is already there, and that's part of what they have to contend with.
See, and that's the thing, like I said, see, we have to keep in mind the, you know, when this was written about these people, right? I mean, it was back when transportation and communication, you know, in any sort of a modern sense, like we talk about, was just getting going. You know, they're talking about they just sort of had cars, and everyone was just like us when we had cars. Everyone was driving everywhere on vacation. You know, they were just in that mode. You know, back when this was written. You know, so since then, right? See, it's gotten a lot more difficult, right? You know, just like Britain. For a long time, Britain was safe because, right, the only way to get there was across the North Sea or the English Channel or, you know, whatever. But once you can shoot V2 rockets, it gets dicier. Right. So
they hit it right on the head for the time, our times mm-hmm. now, though. Yeah. Some things they talk about. It's like this is 55 before, so.
Right, I mean, remember when this is written, this is back in the late 20s and early 30s, right? You know, so, I mean, it wasn't published until 55, but, yeah.
Maybe we could look at it optimistically. What if they're the ones who get the rockets and then everybody, they probably are more technologically advanced, so then they could say, you better wisen up and stop trying
You know it would have started that way, you know, but
maybe they grab it, that would be the bring in a few people, educate them, and send them back to calm down the other societies. If it could have gone that way, but we obviously don't know.
I mean, the obvious parallel that you got to think about is, you know, even though it started here, now North Korea is beginning to, so, right? I mean, you give it enough time, no matter how benighted the society is, right? They're going to eventually have intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. And so, right, you know, you would have that developing there, you know, and, you know, you can, you know, we'll get to this at the end of the paper. More and more, I'm sure there's, the planetary administrators are there is going, boy, it would be really handy if the magisterial sun would come. We needed a serious attention step here. You can imagine it's starting to get dicey there, right, as they try to somehow maintain this one little light shining in the darkness on that island continent. And you can kind of feel that even in the author at the end of the paper. It's like, please, come on, give me the magisterial son. All right, anyway. So we'll keep chugging along next time. It's very interesting. Those are familiar with the paper, the universal suffrage questions here that we'll get to next time. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.